Hi everyone, welcome to the Stage Left podcast. Today we have a belter of an episode with Damon Minchella, founding member of Ocean Colour Scene, and has played with Amy Winehouse, The Who, Noel Gallagher, Liam Gallagher. He currently plays with Richard Ashcroft, and thank you to Damon for allowing us to attend the O2 gig a couple of weeks. Richard Ashcroft gig was absolutely amazing. It was great to see Damon up there doing his thing, and thank you to afterwards as well. We got a chance to meet Richard as well, and there's a great couple of photos of that encounter in that chat on the Instagram page and the Twitter page, which is at the Stage Left Pod, and the Facebook account, which is facebook.com/StageLeftPodcast. And Richard knew of the podcast, which was really, really surreal and really cool. And yeah, there might be more down the line about that. For further episodes, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, where you'll find the likes of Mike Rowe from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds and Oasis, Aziz Ibrahim talking through how he approached replacing John Squire in the Stone Roses for the Reading gigs, and actually colours the interview with examples of him like actually playing Waterfall and I'm the Resurrection and that kind of thing, little clips of it because he had a guitar on his lap, which was really nice, and loads more guests. We're now up to about episode 26, I think, so there's loads of people on there that you might like. Stage Left Extra episode, which I think appears before this one on your list of episodes, is actually myself being interviewed about how we put together the podcast and how we actually put together an album called The Last Wilderness, which is some of the Stage Left guests in the past actually collaborated with the team behind the podcast to release an album. And so we have the likes of Lawrence Juber, who's a double Grammy winning guitarist from Paul McCartney's Wings. He plays guitar on one song called The Other Side. And we have the likes of Elvis Presley's pianist, Shane Keister, playing a Hammond organ on one song. He recorded that in Nashville, a song called Note to Self. So you can find the album at lastwilderness.bandcamp.com, and you can find that interview on there as well. So yeah, I hope you enjoy the episode. Then we'll be back at the end of when will that be? The end of January with Ezra Furman, which was an absolute joy to record that interview as well. That's coming up. So hope you enjoy this. Happy holidays to anyone listening as it goes out, and see you next year. This is Damon Minchella. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. Today's guest has a wealth of experience playing thousands of gigs to millions of fans, firstly as bassist in Ocean Colour Scene, then as bassist for Paul Weller, and most recently with Richard Ashcroft, where he both recorded and toured, and is currently touring Richard's new record, These People. Today we'll be discussing how the music industry compares now to 20 years ago, music and education, the day Damon rejected Noel Gallagher's request for him to join Oasis, collaborating with Amy Winehouse and Dr. John. And we'll also be finding about the time when Damon had to sadly cancel a scheduled DJ set at my best mate's inaugural club night venture in the city, citing the somewhat feeble excuse that he would instead have to fulfil another engagement of performing to one of the biggest television audiences of all time when The Who asked him to play bass for them at Live 8. For any musicians listening, you couldn't want to learn from anyone better. When it comes to bass playing, he's a university, a cosmic library. It's Damon Minchella. Thanks for joining us today, Damon. How's it going?
What a great intro. I love that. Nice little Ashcroft reference there.
There we go.
I'm very well, thank you.
Good stuff. Thanks for joining us. So here we are in a hotel in South London. And I believe you this afternoon you're going to be rehearsing for the upcoming gigs, which I think are in Liverpool, the Echo Arena, and the O2 with the orchestra. So there's a big thing with the orchestra. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we wouldn't normally need to rehearse because the band's playing really well, all Richard stuff. But because we've got a large orchestra playing these two arena shows next month, kind of this is the only time we've got available to get them in, to get the conductor and sort of the MD for the orchestra, just to sort of understand that we may actually not stick entirely to a song arrangement at the end.
Which is kind of terrifying for a lot of classical musicians to hear that.
Yeah, classical musicians are amazing. I've worked with lots of them over the years. But if you ask them to jam a part, they kind of fall to pieces because that's out of their comfort zone. But fortunately, this orchestra, they've done recently working with Pete Tong, and the conductor Will Malone did all the Verve stuff and Richard's solo stuff, so he understands the things may change. So what we'll probably do is sections that may well be jammed out. They will probably have a part written that they can just kind of loop and hopefully use their ears and stop. And stop when we stop.
And how will they approach it? Will they literally learn it from the record, bring that today, play what's on the record, and then you'll just work from there?
Yeah, that's it. That's the plan.
That's the plan.
Yeah, but with music, anything could happen.
There you go. So there's obviously some big gigs coming up. I mean, you've done many kind of large-scale gigs. How did the big kind of marquee gigs sit with you now? Like, you obviously experienced playing to many thousands of people all in, at one time. I wonder if you can contrast and compare the experience of playing to 100,000 people at a festival to kind of the really smaller gigs. How they contrast and compare from a musician's point of view?
Yeah, it's interesting. For me, the perfect size is about 2,500 to 4,000. So sort of Manchester Apollo up to Brixton Academy, gigs where you don't need screens but they're big. Smaller gigs, they're fun, but you have issues with sound. And then when you get to massive gigs, for me they become quite abstract. They're great to play, but after the first 10,000 people, it's just baked beans.
Yeah,
just little dots.
Yeah,
you know. And I always approach it with a sort of massive pinch of salt, and that everything's reasonably amusing, so don't take it too seriously. For instance, supporting Oasis at Nebworth, that was 125,000. My previous gig, biggest gig to that was 80,000, which sounds huge, but then they get bigger. So you play to a quarter of a million with The Who, but they're bigger in terms of people, but they're not bigger in terms of what you can see. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got lights and baked beans.
Yes.
And that's it, really. But interestingly, I remember many years ago doing an OCS arena tour, which was completely sold out, played every arena that you could possibly think of in the UK. And then the next gig was in Norway, so we went from playing to 12,000 people to 300.
Oh,
so that was really interesting, that contrast.
How did it affect you? Was it disappointing?
It was actually really nice to not have all the screens and all the big lights and everything, and just, oh my god, I can actually see the person at the back of the room.
Yeah,
you know, so that was quite cool. Every gig's different though. You know, it really depends on what. There's many factors, but it's how it sounds on stage and what the audience gives back to you. You know, particularly with the sort of music that I've always made, it's not choreographed and it's not the same set every night. So you don't have particular things that are going to happen at a particular moment. It's a lot more. That sounds like a hippie. It's a lot more organic.
Yeah.
So if the audience reacts to things, then that can take things to. Can take off. Whereas if they don't. Yeah.
You kind of touched upon this, but I mean, what, looking back over the kind of thousands of gigs you play, what are the determining factors that go towards a great gig from your point of view? Is it the good sound on stage? Is it feeling well rehearsed? Although you like obviously playing a lot of kind of funk jazz stuff that can be a bit more improvised. What if you look back at those gigs and kind of pick out the three or four, what were the things that really were common between those gigs?
Well, blimey. If I pick some of my favourite gigs, first time I played the Albert Hall, but that was purely for a personal reason because my mum and dad were there.
Oh.
And they were sitting in the Queen's box, so that was amazing. Whereas the Albert Hall itself is not great for rock music because it's built to amplify natural voice. So as soon as you put a PA in there, the sound's not great. So the Albert Hall aesthetically is wonderful, sonically is shit. But my best ever gig with Ocean Colour Scene was Glasgow SECC, which is a big arena, 29th of October 1999. It was one of those perfect gigs where the audience was as good as the band. Everything just aligned.
What was the undercurrent that caused that? Why did you?
I don't know. You get magic sometimes.
Just happened.
Yeah, it just happened. And then I did two gigs recently with Richard, one in Tokyo and the last gig we did in Buenos Aires at the Grand Rex Theatre was just off the scale. Same thing, all the things I kind of mentioned, great sound on stage, the lights felt really cool, the venue looked great, the audience was just pushing you on for more.
Yeah.
And then I've had a few moments with Weller as well in the past. There was a gig in Boston we did many, many years ago, it was only about 1,200 people, but it was one of those ones where the band was just, everything clicked.
Yeah.
You know. There was a really good analogy which Les Patterson, who used to be the bass player in the Bunnymen, said it's like a game of tennis with the audience. When you get one, and even though you took tennis, obviously it falls down because you're trying to beat each other, but you know that we have one of those ridiculous rallies.
Yeah,
it just goes on and on, and it gets more and more and more. So I kind of think that's quite a cool.
That's a good analogy.
As long as I always win.
Richard, in regards to one of the gigs that you played recently, said, I think this was a festival you'd done in Buenos Aires, that he said, thank you for the love last night at the festival. I wasn't happy the real fans were put to one side and the VIPs had a big patch of themselves. I seem to be one of the few musicians that still use monitors. Believe it or not, some stages are completely silent with everyone using in-ear monitors. Mm-hmm. That just ain't music, and sometimes you end up with inferior equipment. So that, I mean, Richard during the gig was quite, I watched it on YouTube, was quite vocal that he was unhappy with the sound. Have you played with in-ear monitors, or has it always been like that, and how did the two compare?
I've never used them.
Okay.
I think I was the only person on stage when I played with The Who that didn't have inner ears. I think I remember their monitor guy was like, you want wedges? Yeah.
Really?
Just out of preference, and in Richard's band, Steve Stanley, the drummer, uses them because we run a lot of tracks, but the rest of the band don't. So that's a really good mix.
What is the benefit? Because most musicians listening to this won't have had the opportunity to use these in-ear monitors and that big kind of production. The people who do use them, what's the benefit to them? Is it they think it's better sound quality or protecting their ears? Or
I don't think it's necessarily protecting their ears. I think it's to get that reliance. It's the same sound every night. And it's really useful if you are using tracks. So everything has to be almost like to a metronome. It's like that band 21 Pilots, who are incredible. I've seen them 3 times. I went to see them on Sunday, just gone. And there's only 2 of them. So it's the singer and keyboard player, who also plays bass and ukulele, and the drummer. Okay, so there's only 2 of them, but there's a lot of extra music going on, so they both use inner ears. And because the singer moves around a lot and he climbs all over the venue, so you couldn't have monitors. For me personally, I mean, I've never used them, so I could be talking absolute nonsense, but I think you lose the interaction with the room and the crowd because you don't hear the space of the room.
Yeah.
I can understand why you would want to use them, because sometimes sounds in arenas, when you're playing big concrete arenas and the sound's coming back at you delayed out of time from the back wall, is horrendous.
Really?
So that's when inner ears would be great. But
What was so bad about the sound on stage at that festival?
It was purely the monitors were quite cheap. Right. So Richard's voice, because he's got such a fantastic voice, and he'd been dying to play in Argentina for 19 years and he was so excited about it. And because every other band at the festival were using inner ears, they hadn't provided great monitors.
Oh.
So for Richard's voice, it wasn't...
He couldn't hear himself?
Couldn't hear himself very... And it didn't sound great, so he was having to over-sing, so he was fucking his voice up a bit.
Yeah.
And when his acoustic guitar sounded naff through them, so obviously it was more frustration. But then 2 days later we played the Grand Rex and they were told that the monitors need to be good, and they were good, and the gig was amazing.
Awesome. There you go.
Yeah.
The margins.
Yeah, exactly.
Good stuff. Okay, so let's go back to growing up. You grew up in, is it right, in Lancashire?
Yes, I was born in Billinge, same hospital as Richard, weirdly.
Really?
So it's me, Richard Ashcroft, and Leon Osman. He used to play for Everton.
Yeah.
We are the sons of Billinge. And then I grew up in Merseyside, Liverpool, and just outside Liverpool, a place called Ainsdale, which is near Southport.
Right.
Till early teens, then the Midlands. So that's my background, and then London, and now Wales.
Tell us about your childhood in regards to music. What was your relationship with music? Were your parents musicians, or?
Well, my relationship to music was football.
Right, okay.
It was just purely I wanted to be a football player. However, my dad used to go to school with George Harrison. And my mum's just been interviewed by a guy called Mark Lewisham, who's the Beatles biographer.
Oh, right.
Because I have, in my office at the university, I've got a picture of George Harrison playing at my dad's 21st birthday party.
Really?
When he was in the Silver Beatles. And they asked my dad to be their tour manager.
Oh, my.
When they had their second tour of Germany, because they bought a van. And my dad was the only one they knew who had a driver's license. So my dad asks his dad, my granddad, can I go on tour with these lot? And or whilst he was supposed to be finishing his accountancy degree, so my granddad basically told him no, but in far more colourful language than that. So they took a guy called Neil Aspinall instead.
Shit.
Yes, who until he died was still Paul McCartney's manager. So I met Neil Aspinall when I played with McCartney in '96, and I got introduced to him. I said, "You've got my dad's job," and he just went, "What are you talking about?" I explained. No musicians in my family, though there was a lot of music, obviously.
Yeah.
And I remember going through my mum and dad's record collection and pulling out the White Album and listening to Back in the USSR on headphones.
Yeah.
And thinking, this is really cool. But then the first music I really got into was Two Tone.
Okay.
But I still didn't want to be a musician until I heard Echo and the Bunnymen, and that was it.
Really? Yeah. And what age was that?
14.
Right.
Yeah, and that took over from football then.
That took, really? Yeah. Right, okay, that replaced it.
There was just a magic in their music, which I hadn't heard yet, you know, and that was it.
That was it?
Yeah, and then I broke my leg really badly, so I couldn't play football for a while, so I started playing guitar instead.
So I was going to say, was it the bass first, or did you play guitar and then...
I got a bass first, purely by accident. I had no idea what was what.
Really?
I had a really bad football accident, because I did want to be a goalkeeper, and I was pretty good, actually. Smashed my leg to pieces in a training match. So I couldn't walk for 6 months. It was that bad. It was completely shattered. So I started just playing guitar along to Burningman Records, then Hendrix Records, and then I eventually worked out, this is the one that makes the low notes, not the high notes. And then I worked out, actually, you need to tune it, because it's... it doesn't stay in tunes.
Yeah.
And then I started just to learn from there and understand what chords were and all that sort of stuff, and then form bands at school, and that was it, really.
Amazing. What were your specific ambitions at the time when you first picking up an instrument, if you look back?
To be as cool as the Bunnymen. That was it. I had no ambitions to make money from it or anything. That never entered the equation. It still doesn't, really, to some degree. I just wanted to be cool, but make cool music. I didn't mean cool as in, you know, be cool and get loads of chicks. That never entered the equation either. It was just, it became a passion, and I wanted to make that magic that I was hearing from all the records that I then started to fall in love with.
And how did your family react to you wanting to then go into music? And like, when things, like, so I know when you met, you met OCS at Stone Roses gig, did you?
Yeah, well, I was already in a band previously with Simon.
Fowler, oh, right, okay.
And then the drummer for a year beforehand. But then we met Steve, who we kind of knew at a Roses gig. And that was it. Then we got the band together.
And when it started kind of looking like this something you were going to do, what was your family? Did they want to
Become they were cool by then. Prior to that, I remember having sitting down with my dad, because I dropped out of sixth form and went to work in HMV because that was the nearest thing I could do to be a musician. And he was like, well, no, you've got to get a job in a bank or something, blah, blah, blah.
Really?
So I sat down with him and I said, look, just give me 2 years. Give me 2 years, and if I haven't got somewhere within 2 years, then I'll go and do
what did he say?
Do a degree and whatnot. He said, all right, you've got two years. 23 months into those 2 years, you got signed.
And what did he say?
He's like, okay, that's it, we'll do it then.
Really?
Yeah, if it had been 24 months and one day, then I probably would have ended up working in a sodding bank.
So do you think having that deadline and that kind of, not pressure from the father, do you think that kind of kept you on the straight and narrow in making sure kind of you achieve that goal of doing something in music? Did it help in a way, or was it a hindrance you thought of?
No, I mean, I've always been relatively optimistic, mixed with sheer stubbornness that it's all going to work out. And I'd probably actually forgotten that the deadline was getting closer, but he reminded me. He said, God, you just squeaked in there.
What would have happened if you hadn't quite by then?
Well, by this point, this was back in the days when you could be on the dole, and the dole were busting my balls to actually get a job.
Yeah.
So I was pretending to look for jobs, but I wasn't.
Yeah.
I would have had to have got a proper job.
Really?
And if you're working a proper job, then you can't make music. You know, not in the way you'd have to back then when there was no music technology.
Yeah.
So
it's one or other.
Yeah, you'd have to do it or not do it. And that used to sort out who really wanted it. You know, I've met loads of people in the past who were musicians when I was, and people I've been in bands with beforehand, and, you know, when they see you on Top of the Pops or something, and then you end up meeting them, and they're all like, oh, God, really jealous, I could have done that. And but you never say it to them, but you think, yeah, but you didn't want to, otherwise you would have.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. You know,
men from the boys, or idiots from the sane, I don't know.
Cool. And talking about, so you met the guys at the Stone Roses gig, you know, OCS, big band around that time. And obviously, you know, you were kind of in close proximity to a whirlwind that was going on in kind of Britain at the time. Mm. What were your personal highlights from that time?
Oh, God, loads of them. There's loads of little standout moments. I remember some festival somewhere, and it was me, Noel and Weller, and we were watching Prodigy, I think. And then I think OCS were about to go on, and then I was going back to play with Noel, and I played with OCS the day before at the same festival, and Noel had come down to watch. And we think it's all changed, isn't it? Because the music we're making is actually the mainstream, but it's cool. Whereas prior to the Roses and then Oasis kicking the doors down, it would have been underground music on a small scale. So there's loads of high points, loads of stuff, like when Be Here Now was the fastest selling album of all time, and then OCS knocked it off the charts 4 days later. You know, we went in at number one.
Yeah.
You know, but you were friends, so we were all just mates.
Yeah.
You know.
And you played hundreds of gigs with OCS.
Shed loads, yeah. And that whole thing, you know, the whole sort of scene was fantastic. But at the time, you're just living it. So, well, I was, you know, working with OCS and Weller both at the same time, and hanging out with Oasis and whatnot, and all those sort of things were great. And then you'd have some really other cool bands like the Charlatans, who actually were predated everyone.
Yeah,
I think OCS's second ever gig was supporting the Charlatans, and things like that. So that was all really cool. And then you got all the hangers on, and all the people trying to get on the coattails, like Menswear and all those sort of god awful bands. You know, we're just trying to copy everything. So, but as every scene would do, you know, I suppose. But all those things have a time, you know, and then they kind of run out. And then, you know, popular consciousness always kind of changes every 3 or 4 years to something new, particularly sort of media playlists and whatnot.
One question I do have is, you just mentioned, if I heard this right, you said that your second ever gig in OCS was supporting the Charlatans. Mm. Right, so how did you go from meeting at the Stone Roses to supporting the Charlatans that quickly? Like, what was that from A to B? What was that journey?
Well, prior to OCS, we had a band, me and Simon had a band called The Fanatics, who were reasonably big in Birmingham, if you can be. And we already had a record deal and a publishing deal, and then we sort of mutated into Ocean Colour Scene.
Gotcha. Right.
So we already had
a bit of a following.
So we already had things in place. We had the guy who used to manage the Finding Cannibals was our publisher. And I think through that connection, we got the gig support in the Charlatans. And then we made a bunch of, no, fast forward a few years, well, 2 or 3 years, we made it, started making a few demos and whatnot. Oh, actually, I'm totally missing out an entire record deal here.
Okay.
The very first album with Ocean Colour Scene, when we signed to Phonogram, which was a disaster.
Why?
Because we weren't any good. And we got signed at the time, sort of cut the back end of Baggy, you know, the whole sort of Roses thing. And we weren't ever that. But the record label wanted us to be that. So we started making a record with a guy called Jimmy Miller, who produced the Rolling Stones, to get that 60s thing, and it was engineered by a guy called Steve Osborne, who'd worked with good god Paul Oakenfold. So it was that 60s meets the 90s sort of baggy thing, and the record was a bit, well, it wasn't great. And then grunge happened, so then the record label wanted us to be a grunge band, and then the grunge and then they put us in with a producer who's a really nice guy called Tim Palmer, who'd done a Mother Love Bone album, who then went on to become Pearl Jam and whatnot. And he knew that we weren't a grunge band, but he was kind of tasked with making us more rock. So it just didn't work, and then the whole thing fell to pieces.
What were you thinking around this time when they're telling you that you're being dictated to by record companies over what style your band should be?
We just wanted to leave.
Yeah.
And then eventually it got to the point where we could leave, and we walked away from them. We left them with a huge amount of debt, which was their fault. And that's when we then started writing all the songs that became Mosey Shoals, you know.
And this is right, you engineered 90% of that record?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was playing bass and working at the desk at the same time.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that out of, because there was no one else to do
There's
it?
There's no one else, no.
Really?
A guy called Andy McDonald, who has got a record label called Independiente. He used to have go-discs.
Yeah.
He loved our demos, but Andy's already worked on the premise that he only has a certain amount of bands signed to his label. And
right.
So he had Travis and the Lars and whatnot. But he loved what we were doing. Yeah. So he gave us 10 grand and a 16-track desk and a quarter-inch tape machine and 4 microphones. So we found a space to put them in. I worked out how to use them. So then we made the record.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was it. So without Andy, we wouldn't have been able to afford the rent on the space that we had.
Yeah.
And I just worked out how to use it.
It's not going anymore, Independiente, is it?
Yeah, it is. It's more of a publishing company thing there.
Now, you talked about growing up, you like kind of different styles of music, and you know, was it a challenge bringing that to the party in OCS and those early bands? Were you, because they're obviously quite rocky bands, and you're into kind of a lot of funk stuff as well, were you trying to merge the two, or were you just trying to, how did that work, that relationship between what you wanted to play and maybe what the band wanted to play?
I think everyone has different influences. I mean, the drummer in Ocean Colour Scene is a big reggae drummer, really. Yeah. That's really what he is. But obviously, you couldn't really have a reggae backbeat with the songs that we were doing. Yeah. I mean, one of my main musical loves is hip hop, but I will never be a rapper or a hip hop producer. But you can just take those things and put them in, because it's all. I never tried to put some sort of jazz bass line or a funk thing into something. Everything just becomes. Again, I sound like a hippie, it's an organic process of stuff which just become what it is if you're a good musician, and by that I mean you listen to each other and work as a team.
Did you have that kind of creative outlet though that you might have wanted to, given the way that you wanted to play?
Oh god, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I started up I've always had extra things on the go.
Yeah.
So I started a thing called The Players with Steve White and Aziz Ibrahim and Mick Talbert, and that was
Aziz on a recent episode actually. Yeah, he was talking about
and that was to do more of a thing, more of a not experimental, but more off that, you know, sort of jazz, sort of soundtracky, funk based thing. You know, so I've always got extra stuff going on.
Just quickly go back to, you know, you're talking about kind of going through to Nebworth and that kind of the scale of that. Mm. And for listeners, I mean, there'll be a lot of listeners that do know, but for the ones that don't, Oasis played these gigs at Nebworth that were 2.6 million people applied for tickets just for those gigs alone, which is 4% of the population. Mm. It was such a cultural movement that, like, Oasis tribute band, Noasis, had like a top 15 single and were on Top of the Pops. It was just a crazy movement, which Damon was in close proximity to the whole time. And did you realise the scale of what was going on at the time? Because it affected lots of different culture, not just music. And do you think they did?
Yeah, you did. But I think I kind of mentioned it earlier that it's your day-to-day life. So when you step out of it, you can understand it. When it really hit home to me was I was trying to buy a pair of shoes in London in a shop called Patrick Cox. And this girl saw me. She screamed, burst into tears and ran out.
Oh.
So the shop assistant's looking at me as though I've done something wrong. Like, you know, I've been inappropriate I've hit her or something. And that's when I thought, okay, this is quite... It's quite bizarre, you know. And then lots of other things, like being at my first wife's dad's hotel in Penzance on New Year's Eve, standing outside having a fag. And before I know it, there's 50 people wanting my autograph.
Wow.
You know, just because some person seen me. So that was quite odd. But
how did that affect you?
As I said, same with big gigs, I always treat it with a massive pinch of salt and sense of humour, you know, because it's a bit daft, really.
Surreal.
It is surreal. And I can understand why people get like that. I've only ever been like that with one person when I met Duncan Ferguson. He used to be... Everton Striker is now on the coaching staff. I met him once and I was that trembling fan, you know, whereas...
They call them fangirls now.
Fangirls. I was that fangirl.
Forward a little bit, let's get to the subject. Griggsy left Oasis, and is it right that when you were going to do Top of the Pops for Carnation, what happened?
Yeah, the conversation was there. So it was me, Noel, Liam, Alan White, driving up to Birmingham to mime the Liam and Steve Craddock cover of the Jam song Carnation, which had just become a hit single.
Noel was playing piano.
Yes.
Bizarrely.
Yeah. He was miming. He was miming piano because it was actually Steve.
Weller's part, was it?
Steve played it.
Oh, right, okay.
But anyway, and Griggs had left and they were talking and it basically came up with a conversation, do you want to do it? Which basically meant, I said, yeah, of course, but, you know, with OCS and Weller. He said, yeah, but you'd have to, you can't be married to anyone else. So you'd have to basically walk, the intimation was leave those two acts. And to be honest with you, I probably could have ditched Weller for Oasis, but I couldn't ditch Ocean Colour Scene.
Yeah.
To join a band that already existed, because Ocean Colour Scene was obviously my band. So it was never, it was there, but it was never going to happen.
So this was in the period just after Bonehead and Grigsby left, and before Stand on the Shoulders came out and their big tour books. Do you think, looking back, that that whole Carnation thing was a bit of a kind of audition for you and Steve Craddock? Because if you look at the band, right, so with Noel's in the background playing piano, playing guitar just on the video, and that band lineup was Alan White for Top of the Pops, and Steve played it on the video, but Alan White, Liam, Noel, they needed a bassist, who they asked, which was you, and Steve Craddock.
Yeah.
It was a big audition.
Yeah, probably was.
And then you've gone, no, it's all right. And Noel's just thinking, what the fuck have I done this?
it probably was, actually. Noel. But it's funny, because I hadn't seen Noel for donkey's years. Last time I saw him, I think about 2004. And then I was doing a gig with Richard in Glasgow, and Noel was playing as well. So it was really nice to see him, actually. He looks exactly the same as he's always looked.
What was his reaction when you said no, though? Like, how did that come? Was it just the two of you talking, or was it off the cuff? Was it a joke, or was it...
No, we're all in the van. Liam.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Liam in the van, in some posh car, actually. But yeah. Liam was all like, he was really excited, as Liam always is. And I just kind of left it there, really, you know. I kind of just let it disappear, because I couldn't... Yeah, financially, it probably would have been a wonderful thing, but I just couldn't do it. You know,
yeah.
Actually, couldn't, you know, all those things that you built up with your own band, you can't just go.
No.
Actually, do you know what, lads? I'm going to jump ship to the next bigger band.
No.
You know, no.
Fair enough. Good, good kudos for you there, man. You did the right thing, but yeah, man, you would have been a good bassist in Oasis. Mm. You would have brought something very interesting to the band, I think.
Yeah, I'd have played too many notes, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so you've not really spoken about leaving OCS before. Mm. What happened? And, you know, how comes you didn't play in the band, but you did carry on playing with Craddock and Weller?
Yeah, so it would have been, I think it was 2004. We were doing an acoustic tour of Ireland, which never my particular thing to do acoustic shows. But prior to that, we were making the last studio album was on. And I just realised halfway through that I was bored of it. I was bored of the direction we were going. It was becoming far less rock, a lot more folky. There's mandolins getting brought out and all sort of stupid instruments like that. And I just thought, you know what, I've had enough. At that point, I'd been playing with Simon, the singer, for 19 years, mm-hmm. Oscar, the drummer, for 17, and Steve Craddock for 15 years. That's a long time.
Mm.
And it's not just working with them. Say if you're working with someone at a factory 15 years, you get to the point where you don't, you know, they're annoying, but that's every other day of your life in their company.
Mm.
So on the tour bus, even after a gig, same hotel, same everything. And it just got to the point where I thought, you know what, I don't need this. And I've never made money for music, so I remember talking to my wife at the time, and she was like, well, just leave at the end of the big electric tour we were going to do. And I had that in the back of my mind, so I was going to leave anyway, and just halfway through this Irish tour, we'd done the gig, and I thought, I'm bored of this. So I just got off the tour bus.
Spoken to the guy since, or spoken to the
I bumped into Simon a couple of years later. He looked petrified. I think he thought I was going to beat him up or something, so I just gave him a hug. That was that. I hadn't seen the drummer. And then I carried on working with Steve Craddock with Weller for 3 years.
So how did that work? So if you any young musicians listening to this, you're going to be in bands at the time with complex personal relationships. Mm. How did that work? Because that must have been weird, leaving the band but then still being...
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was weird at first, but there was no way I was going to stop working with Paul.
Yeah.
And so I phoned him the day after and told him, and he thought I was then not going to work with him. I said, no, of course I was going to work with you, because, you know, it's great. So it was a bit odd at first. First couple of rehearsals, it was a little bit sort of pasted on smiles. But then, you know, you do a couple of gigs with Paul, everyone has a few drinks, and then it kind of just becomes, not the same as it was, but definitely workable with Steve Craddock.
Wow.
You know, and then he texted me about 3 months ago or something, told me how much he loved me.
Oh.
It's Craddock. But then I realised he was on tour in Australia. So I was getting the text at 4 in the afternoon. That this is 4 in the morning for him, so I imagine he was actually rather drunk.
Oh, bless him.
But yeah, bless him.
And any regrets about leaving the OCS? Or?
No.
Not really.
No, not at all.
That's one that that's that one nipped in the bud.
Yeah,
cool.
Oh yeah, and if anyone wants to know, no, I will never rejoin them.
Okay.
Because I get those questions all the time.
Do you?
Okay, whenever they're doing the 21st anniversary of this album or the
25th
anniversary.
Because given that you started though, given that you say that you know,
I hate it when bands get back together. There's a time and a place.
Mm.
You know, and that's purely from my experience of being an Eck and Burning Man fan. Because when I became a fan of theirs, they were untouchable. And then they split up. And then they reformed, and it's never the same.
Never the same.
You know, so no, it's also always a bit Spinal Tap as well.
Yeah.
You know, come on, join us. Just come and play two songs. And,
yeah.
Nah, fuck it.
Never gonna happen. Sad, man, but you know, you
ooh, no, it's not. It's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
It's
yeah.
a good thing.
Okay. Okay. So other things you did. Let's talk Live 8.
Mm.
Right. So for people who don't know, I'm sure you will. Live 8 was kind of 20 years on from, or 25 years, 20, 25 years on
yeah.
from Live Aid, a series of coordinated gigs worldwide that were going to have one of the biggest TV audiences of all time. You played, was it Hyde Park?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Hyde Park, and the people on this bill that day was McCartney, U2, Madonna, Elton John, Snoop Dogg, Pink Floyd obviously mm-hmm. headlined, which was their first gig in many years as well. You would have got a call, I'm guessing, saying The Who, do you want to play? So talk us through that.
Yeah, I got the call the week before. The week before, yeah. I got the call saying, do you want to come and play with us next week?
From whom?
From their management.
Okay.
So I said, yeah, where are we playing? I said, oh, don't you know? I just thought it was like a club gig or something. Oh, we're going to do Live 8. Oh, okay. Wow. Brilliant. So I immediately went to the pub. I was living in a little village, went to the pub. In my excitement, I locked myself out of the house. So I went to the pub, had three or four pints, told everyone in the pub, they're all over it, buying me extra drinks. Went back to my house, couldn't get in, so I had to break in, and then the police turned up. Because a neighbour had heard all this breaking glass, and then the police turned up. So very drunken me, he was explaining. But one of the policemen recognised me.
Did he?
And he's like, oh, okay, don't worry about it. Yeah, okay, I know who you are. So then we rehearsed the day before for an hour.
Right, so they said, so you did two songs, right?
Yeah, so but we had a set list of six songs. We played each song twice, and then Pete Townsend said, yeah, that's cool, I'll see you tomorrow.
Really?
So we had like Won't Get Fooled Again, which is about 9 minutes long. We ended up, I only played it twice before we went on play to, you know,
and when did
huge
they,
audience.
So those six songs, does the manager send you a message, just a message saying, these are the six, learn them off the record?
Kind yeah.
of thing, pretty much, and yeah. you just, you, how did you approach that? Just put the CD player on?
Yeah, I listened to some of Ent Whistle's parts and picked the bits that I liked.
Really? So did you change that?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
No way!
Yeah, I only kept three of his parts on Won't Get Fooled Again. Because he plays too many notes, so I play a lot of lower stuff, so it was a lot more powerful, which is what Roger Daltrey said to me.
So I was going to say, what feedback did they give to you?
I thought it was amazing, and Simon Townsend, who Pete's brother who plays in the band,
yeah,
I sort of met him at live at Isle of Wight. When I was playing there with Richard, and he was saying, God, you made those songs sound fantastic. And the reason why is I could play less notes, but louder, lower notes.
Wow, really?
So it creates a lot more attitude.
Were you nervous about kind of touching, like, John Entwistle's parts, you know? And like, no, he didn't.
No, he's never, I mean, he's an amazing bass player, and The Who are fantastic. But Entwistle was never an inspiration for me.
Right, okay.
I know he's a.
Were you worried how that might be perceived, though? Like, you know, not really.
Well, again, I think it's my optimism mixing with stubbornness. I just thought, well, they've asked me to do it, so I'm going to do it how I do it. Obviously, if Townsend had said, "No, you've got to play this part," I'd have then learnt it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not that big-headed that I think, well, okay, my opinion is more important than yours, particularly as it's their songs. But I just thought, well, they've asked me, so they obviously like what I do.
What were those rehearsals like? I know you said it was only for kind of an hour or two,
but
are they kind of, because Steve White played as well, had he played with them before, or was it both of you playing for the first time?
Both of us for the first time. Right. We'd done stuff with Daltrey.
Okay.
And Ocean Colestina did a whole bunch of shows with supporting The Who in America back in the late 90s. So kind of, they knew, you know, that's what obviously.
Here's the link. Right.
Yeah, one of the reasons why they asked me was through OCS and my Weller work, and obviously Steve White through Weller. So we were obviously the perfect sort of replacement.
Steve White said to you before you walked on stage for that gig, if we fuck this up, our career's over.
Yes. And as he was saying this to me, standing next to me and him are Sting and Bob Geldof. But anyway, so then we go, funnily enough, we then go on stage. And we've done Who Are You? And then the second song is Won't Get Fooled Again. which has got 17 and a half bar, this sort of synth loops, which Pete Townshend put together in the late 60s. Steve White has to come in after 17 and a half bars.
Oh.
He 13 bars into it, he turns around and mouths to me, "Where the fuck are we, really?" And I said, 13, 2, 3, 4, 14, and then counted him in.
Oh, man.
And if I hadn't known, we would have fucked it up, because he'd have come in at the wrong place, and then the backing track would have been out of time. Out of
shit.
Scene. Yeah.
Margins,
yeah, absolutely. I know.
Cool. Well, we've got Steve White on this podcast in a few weeks as well, so I'll have to run that by him.
Oh,
as well.
He will agree.
Remember that.
I saved him.
You saved him. Okay, cool. Okay, and what were your memories of the actual day like? It must have been such a surreal day, even across the in front of the stage. I watched it yesterday. Across the front of the stage, it says, "The world is watching."
Yeah.
Preparations on that day must have been just mad.
What was weird is they put us up at a really nice hotel on the other side of Hyde Park. So I had the windows open, because it was also men's final at Wimbledon, I think. So I was watching a bit of that.
Right.
And then U2 started, so I could hear them. And then Coldplay come on, and Richard Ashcroft gets on, does a bit of symphony with them. And that's when it started to get a bit exciting. And then we got picked up by a car. We went backstage. But backstage was hilarious, because you've got Madonna's there, you've got the Beckhams there, all these...
Brad Pitt and all that.
Yeah, all these huge international superstars. And also loads of road crew and musicians that I knew, who were all enjoying hospitality. But because I'd only played these songs twice the day before, I thought I'd just lay off all booze. So I was just standing there drinking water, waiting. So it was actually really crap.
Yeah.
Until we went on stage, and Robbie Williams ran over, so that was taking forever.
So you went on after Robbie Williams before
the Pink Floyd.
Right,
yeah.
Okay, cool, right.
So it was actually a long, long wait, but the beer I had after we came on stage is the greatest beer I've ever had.
What was it?
Don't know.
Just because you really got
It was one of those moments.
Recommendation there, like some IPA or something like that.
It was probably Red Stripe or something awful. But it was just that moment, like, thank God for that.
Yeah, I bet. Cool, yeah. Man. Nice one. Okay, so other people you've played with, notable people, Jimmy Page, McCartney, Winehouse, any interesting anecdotes or stories around those? I mean, that's...
Amy Winehouse made, bless her soul, made a fantastic cup of tea.
Right. What was the context of that? Studio?
We're in a rehearsal studio. So I did some stuff with her, which was great. And that wasn't long before she died, actually.
Really?
Probably a couple of years before she passed away. But she was lovely.
And what were the rehearsals like? Because some of her gigs around that time, I saw a couple of those 2 years before, and she was obviously a bit...
Yeah, I think that when I did my little stint with her, that was just before she started to go off the rails. So she was lovely. Paolo Martini is an amazing singer.
Yeah.
But he bends over like an old man when he's singing, so he needs to sort his posture out. Jimmy Page... Wow.
What was the context of that?
Doing a thing at the Albert Hall, a charity gig. And he's like a evil granddad. he's an acid-fried evil granddad. So he's actually a really nice guy, but he's so abstract, because I think of all the stuff he's done back in the day.
Can you elaborate?
Because we had a break from rehearsals, so we went down to catering. And I said to him, "Oh, Jimmy, I'll get you a sandwich. What do you want?" And such a direct, simple, normal question. He couldn't compute. He couldn't understand how to answer it.
Right.
You know, "I'll get you a sandwich. What do you want?" And it was like I'd said something in Chinese to him. It was bizarre. And then there was a power cut in the rehearsals. And then you just heard this guy at the back saying, "Did you get me that sandwich?" In the dark, this is the Prince of Darkness standing behind you, asking you for the sandwich that he couldn't ask you for in the first place.
Oh man,
very strange and hilarious guitarist, because we were doing everything instrumentally. He said, "I'll nod you for the changes, for the section changes." So say Dazed and Confused, which he presumed I'd know.
Right,
I never knew how to play. So I had to get him to show me the bass part.
Really?
Too. Yeah.
Oh man.
But then how'd
that go down? Like,
I think he thought it was quite funny, actually.
Oh, okay.
But. As soon as we then started playing the song, instead of nodding me for the change, me and Steve White for the changes, he just turns around with his mouth open, just going like this for the whole 9 minutes. So there were no changes to be nodded for. So me and the drummer, we just guessed what all the changes were without the vocals, and I think we got them right. He seemed quite pleased, didn't he?
Shit.
Yeah. So that was a great experience with, one of Led Zeppelin. And oddly enough, I met Robert Plant the other day.
Did you?
In the village I live in, Wales. It's near Rockfield Studios, so he was rehearsing there, and he came down to the pub, which has got rooms and a restaurant. So he was sitting behind me and my wife, and then he heard us talking about music, and he said, "You're Damon, aren't you?"
He knew you.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So yeah, I've had dinner with Robert Plant and played Jimmy Page.
Really?
Yeah.
What was dinner with Robert Plant like?
It was funny. Yeah, he looks like Gandalf.
Does he?
Yeah, nice guy though.
Did you tell him that story about Jimmy Page?
Oh God, yeah, totally, totally. He thought it was hilarious.
Cool. And Macca. You say 96?
I think it was 96. Might have been 97. Was around that time. The Help album for Bosnia, the War Child thing. Yeah.
Johnny Depp played on that as well. Is that right?
Johnny Depp was just there, being insane.
Oh right. Okay. Right. Okay.
Yeah, he's a very strange guy.
Yeah. Go on.
Johnny Depp was collecting everyone's cigarette butts and putting them in the turnips of his jeans.
Really?
Yeah. And so you'd put your cigarette out in the ashtray and you say, "Hey man, can I take that?" Yeah. And he'd roll up, turn my jeans, stick it in there. Who knows? But that was great, playing with McCartney.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I think I own that. Yeah, yeah. So that's when, you know, Oasis do Fade Away. They did a version of Fade Away.
Yeah.
That was acoustic. And yeah, I remember that. Weller was on that as well.
Weller was that, yeah. So we did Come Together.
Oh, you played. Oh, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. So I'm playing that on a violin bass as well, whilst Paul McCartney's sitting next to me.
Really?
So again, and again, that was a total sort of massive pinch of salt. It's all quite a bizarre moment. Because if you hadn't, you'd be thinking, you wouldn't be able to play, really, would you? You know,
it's you're playing his bass line in front of him.
Yeah, on a violin bass whilst he's sitting next to me.
Oh man!
But
what was that interaction like? Did he kind of give you a nod of like?
Oh yeah, he said, and I played this really nice bass chord. Excuse me. And he said nice chords, and I said, yeah, they're bootcut because I had some bootcut chords.
Oh man!
And then he went down into the live room and he did a guitar solo on it, and everyone's in absolute awe in the control room at Studio B, Abbey Road. He finishes playing. He says, "What was that like down the talkback mic?" And before anyone could get to the talkback mic in the control room, I just went, "It was shit." And then he'd written a new song. So then there was this bit where we had a jam for about an hour where he's playing drums and I'm playing bass.
No.
Yeah.
What was the song? Do you know?
It was awful.
Really?
But he's playing drums and singing and I'm playing bass. And that was so cool.
Do you know what the song's called?
I don't think they didn't record it. It got recorded, but it wasn't that good.
Really? But,
yeah, that was really cool. He's a lovely guy, and Linda was there as well. She was really nice.
Yeah.
And obviously Neil Aspinall and whatnot. Yeah, that was very cool.
I know you say like you take it with a pinch of salt, but that's unusual. I think like a lot of people would bit like, well, okay, let's talk Duncan Ferguson.
Yes. Yeah.
Right, okay. So you know, if you're playing bass, with Paul McCartney playing drums, or you know, Paul McCartney sat there. How do you deal with that as a musician and kind of not be kind of like, what the fuck, and let that distract what you're doing?
I think maybe I'm just the way I'm hardwired, I don't know.
Except if it's Duncan Ferguson.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always just approached it, as I said, you know, it's actually slightly funny what you do for a living, being a musician. And if you got really serious and you analysed it, like, you wouldn't be able to walk out in front of 80,000 people. Mm. Or, you know, Live 8. You've only played the songs twice and it's been beamed around the world and you're playing with The Who and you don't know the songs. You know, you'd fall to pieces, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So I think
it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah, so I think I always just thought, well, and I also known that I'm pretty good at what I do as well. Yeah. Without, you know,
no,
not being big headed, but I know how to play. So just do my thing.
Question, Dr. John. Now what a tune that was. I discovered it yesterday. I think you played on two, but I heard one. Yes. Called I Don't Want to Know.
Yeah.
And this lineup, I believe, is Weller's on there playing guitar and backing vocals. It's yourself, Jules Holland's playing piano, and Dr. John's doing vocal. I'm guessing he did a bit of piano as well.
Yeah, perhaps. That's right.
What was the context of that?
Well, it was a Dr. John album, which is record label wanted to use some well-known UK musicians at the time. I wasn't supposed to be playing on it. Dr. John was supposed to be playing bass on those two songs.
Right.
And I was doing some B-sides with Ocean Colour Scene at a studio. I got a call at midnight from the producer to our studio saying, do you want to play with Dr. John tomorrow? Yeah, okay. You know, what the songs are, don't worry about it. We'll just make them, you know, it'll be fine. You'll pick them up. I then proceeded to have a little bit too much to drink. I was chasing the studio dog around the kitchen. Broke my toe.
Oh.
Woke up with a hangover. Got woken up with a hangover by the roadie who was driving me down to Abbey Road, saying, "Come on, get up. We're playing. You got to play with Dr. John." So I turned up in abject pain, but I'm limping and he limps. So I think he thought I was taking the piss out of him.
Shit.
Yeah, but he was great to work with because I couldn't understand a word he was saying because his New Orleans slang is so undecipherable. So he's saying something to me about the bass part, and I'm just nodding.
Really?
I have no idea what you're saying. So I just ignored it and carried on anyway. But that was cool, yeah.
And who's kind of directing the thing? Did you ever like a producer then, or was it?
There was a guy called John Leckie. He's a really nice guy, so I kind of thought, well, if John, you know, I'd play some parts and say, John, is that all right? He says, oh, yeah, that's great.
Was it a live recording, or was it?
Yeah, oh, yeah, no, it was all live, yeah. No, that was cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I saw Dr. John a few years ago.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to know.
Some education stuff. Mm. You worked for a couple of universities. You're currently at, is it University of South Wales?
South Wales,
right? Okay, as well as obviously doing the Ashcroft stuff at the time. At the same time, advice for musicians. Okay, this is obviously a broad question. The first thing I'd say is that I think you got tendonitis quite badly a few years ago.
Yeah.
For bassists or musicians, is anything looking back you were doing wrong that you would give?
I mean, I was horrendous. I never used to warm up.
Right.
I would just go and do a gig, and so if you don't warm up, particularly playing bass, because it is it's probably the most labour intensive sort of hand instrument.
Mm.
People think drums are, but they're not. It's, if you're playing bass, it's a lot worse on your tendons. So I would never ever warm up. So you'd go on quite sort of uptight and then play, and then if you overplay a bit, then your tendons start to swell up, and that's what my issue was. So then I just learnt that you have to breathe. And if you breathe, then it circulates the blood, circulates the oxygen, which then makes your tendons sort of decrease in size. They don't swell up, get less inflamed. But I've had to change the position I play the guitar. So I'd have to flatten out my hand instead of bending my hand over like that. I play it like that, which means that I have rolled my shoulder over. So I've now got there you go. That's the sound of my shoulder. really bad shoulder ache.
Shit.
But it was either stop playing or adopt a new position. I mean, I went to see a hand specialist. He said, "Well, you've got two choices. Three choices. We can do surgery on your arms, but I don't advise it because you might lose the speed in your fingers. You can stop playing, you've got to work out a new position."
Really?
So that's what I did. I worked out a new sort of position to play.
How talk us through that. Was that a real challenge to get out of the habit that you've had for so many years?
I had about 80 gigs lined up the day after I went to see him. With OCS, so I had to make something work.
So it was that early this started happening. So were you started, still at OCS?
Started just before we did the March on the Radio Arena tour, so 97. Yeah, all of a sudden, totally out of the blue, we were doing production rehearsals, and my right hand went into absolute sheer agony, spasms, and cramp.
Fuck.
Yeah, and that was it. So we went straight to the hand specialist. Said this is what it is.
So advice to
you
bassists:
have to warm up and watch your hand positions. And when you're rehearsing and practicing, if it starts to hurt, stop immediately. Adrenaline will get you through a gig because you have to, because you're being paid for it. But if it's a rehearsal situation or a practicing situation, as soon as you feel something start to burn, stop. The problem with doing sort of repetitive things, physical stuff, is that after a while everything wears out and your body rejects doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly playing bass. And pianists get it a lot as well, is your body just says, I don't want to do this anymore. So you have to work out when to stop, and you don't want to be in a position where you have to start changing your position that you play, or taking cortisone injections or anything like
that.
You know, because that just masks it. So if it hurts, stop, unless you're being paid, and then get through to the end,
and then stop.
Yeah.
Okay, so around teaching, it's how do you find that? So, because there's plenty of great teachers and tutors who weren't great musicians, there's many great musicians who weren't great teachers and tutors. How was that a challenge? Because I think you've even written a degree, you were telling me before. And
I've written a new degree for the University of South Wales, the BA Popular and Commercial Music. I've been doing it for about 8 years now. And when I originally started, I just actually had a horrendous hand injury, where I severed the tendons to my right hand, so I couldn't play for 6 months. And I started doing music performance lecturing and bass lecturing. So I had to, my way of teaching, I had to describe what I wanted people to do, but I couldn't show them because I wasn't allowed to play. So that was a really good in, because I then had to think on my feet how to communicate to late teenagers, early 20s, what I wanted them to do, but without actually showing. So that was a really good way in. And then I carried on and started doing music business lectures. And
did you get training and teaching? Or
no.
Really?
No. I just was obviously good at it, and then started doing more sort of musicology stuff, like analysing music. And then through that, started doing my PhD. And
what is your PhD focus on? Because I believe for a PhD, you have to come up with a pretty original idea.
Yeah,
right?
No one has ever done a study on the phenomenology of making popular music in the UK. And by that, I mean the experience of it. So what the creative process involves, what it's like for the practitioners who do it, so professional musicians. So basically, I interviewed a lot of people I know, who are all really highly regarded musicians, session players, engineers, producers, songwriters, and what have you. And no one's ever done this. So that's why when I put the proposal forward, pretty much all the universities I sent it to were all over it.
Cool. How far are you into it?
I am 86,000 words into it.
My
limit is 80,000, and I've still got 2 chapters to write.
Right, okay.
So I'm probably got about 20,000 words over. I submitted it's supposed to be the 9th of December, the day I play the O2 with Richard, but I'm going to put it back a month. So I submit in 2 months.
Cool.
So Easter time, it'd be Dr. Minchella, thank you very much. fingers crossed, but it will be.
Cool. So you touch upon playing with Richard there. Hypothetically, what would a songsmith or a singer learn from working with Richard Ashcroft that he wouldn't learn from anyone else?
Oh, with Richard, you would learn you have to just go with your gut instincts. What Richard's amazing, because he is not a technical musician at all. Most songwriters I know pretty much all the chords that exist. Mm-hmm. Richard knows 6 chords.
Yeah, C, A minor, F, G.
Yeah, he doesn't. You know, he can't even play a B minor.
Right.
He has to put a cap up and play an A minor.
Yeah.
So Richard tends to use the same 6 chords, but he, out of those 6 chords, the tiny little inflections he will play, the way he plays a D chord, will then form the melody that he sings over the top.
Right.
And he can get so much out of such a small array. So out of his limitations, is what helps him to create. So he has such a small palette of what he can physically play, but his mind then runs amok over the top of those.
Because a good example of that, I guess, is, I don't know if you've heard the demo for Science of Silence. You might not have done, but so Richard sings all the orchestral parts over it as well. So you've obviously been in the studio with him. Mm-hmm. Is that how it is? Is that it? Kind of, it's his thing, and he kind of builds it up from the.
Yeah, and Richard's really good at collaborating as well, and he'll have ideas. So you know, maybe some programming things. So we'll get someone in to do it, and then he'll then build on that. But Richard is very. He's very attuned to exactly how he wants things to sound, and he doesn't bullshit his way through the songwriting process. Whereas a lot of songwriters, because they're maybe more technically skilled, if the vocal melody is not that great, then maybe they'll put in a really nice chord change just to keep people's ears moving along. Whereas with Richard, the melody he's singing has to be fabulous. Otherwise, it's not going to work. For instance, like Bittersweet Symphony, we've done that. Which is, the chords are E, B minor, D sus 4, A. Richard can't play B minor. So we did it at a radio session without all the orchestra. So he played E, D and A, and he started singing a Bangles song over the beginning, Manic Monday, which Prince wrote,
and then
went into Bittersweet Symphony. And it still holds water as that song because
of his... He played the D instead of B minor.
Yeah,
because it's a relative minor, isn't it? So, yeah,
but because of his his lyrics and his vocal melody, the whole thing stands up.
No change, I can change, I can change, I can change, but I'm here in my mold. I am here in my mold, and I'm a million different people from one day to the next. I can change my mold. Oh no, oh no.
Sing your bass lines to you?
No.
So he just kind of writes a song. He says,
"Yeah, I mean,
put something to this."
Unless he's got a specific idea,
yeah.
In which case, I'll probably go, "Yeah, okay, I get what you're saying," and then do my version of it, just to try and sort of facilitate it better. But in general, same as working with Weller, it's kind of just do your thing. And then maybe, like, you know, there was one song we were doing, and he wanted me to play less. So I was playing it as a bass player, and then he just said, "All right, just take out that fucking third note. Take out the fucking third note, and the bass line sounds fantastic." You know, and he doesn't know what that third note's called. He just says that,
just
third,
that third note. Yeah.
And that I really appreciate that. I think it's really refreshing. You know, he's completely unschooled, but an absolute talent.
What was the blueprint for the album? So were you in the pre-production meetings and that kind of thing, or were you brought in later on?
Myself and a drummer called Jeff Dugmore, we were brought in. 4 days, and we recorded 26 songs.
In 4 days?
Yeah. Some of them.
So
were,
a lot of the record had been done by then?
Some were, some of those little backing track ideas, little snatches of vocal melodies, fine. Some little samples, or Richard recorded it himself, playing guitar or whatnot. Some of them were completely live. And Richard just likes to bang everything down, and then think about it later, really.
From those pre-production meetings, what were the things the album was trying to achieve, or perhaps trying to avoid?
I think, Richard always wants to be inspired by what he's writing, so to avoid what he's done before.
Right.
You know, I think that's probably the same for most songwriters, is to not repeat yourself, or to not consciously repeat yourself anyway. I think Richard was just excited about making music again, you know, because he'd taken quite a while not doing it. So, and then he found the right musicians to work with, and then Jeff couldn't do some other stuff for some reason, then Steve Sedelnik, who's the drummer, came in, and Steve does a lot of programming. And we were working with Chris Potter, who I'd worked with on many records before, and with other artists.
Was it that link that you came in?
Yeah.
What, you got the phone call from
Chris? Chris said, "Do you want to work with Richard?" I said, "Yeah, of course," because I knew Richard to say hello to her over the years of just bumping into him with the Verve and whatnot. So that was just sort of hit off straight away. We both got the same opinions about most things, apart from football, because he supports Man United. But we let that go.
Have you seen him play it when he played at Old Trafford a couple of years ago?
No.
It's like a soccer aid thing.
Was he any good?
No, he's fucking awful.
He thinks he's good. He tells me he's
good. Okay, so yeah, he's not a genius in that field. Mick Jagger once said his biggest fear was losing his voice. So does Richard, Richard's got an incredibly soulful voice. Mm. Does he consciously take care of his voice, you know, or does he just roll with the punches? Or?
He consciously takes care of his voice about an hour before going on stage, where he makes these weird-looking smoothies and drinks, got this strange hot drink. Whereas prior to that, he would talk so much while smoking 800 cigarettes, and then straight after the gig he will be non-stop talking while smoking a huge amount of fags. So I think he has this thing, if he goes through the process of pretending to take care of his voice, then it'll all be all right.
Amazing. That's cool. It's, you know,
I wouldn't recommend that, obviously, to
no singers. Yeah,
you should do all the right things.
Yeah,
he doesn't warm up his vocals either. He just goes and sings.
Really?
Yeah.
Does he sing at rehearsal? At sound checks and stuff?
He does, but we tend to just jam new ideas. Is it my genes that have made me? Is it the things I took? Is it the things I said this time of rule? Well, if there's a God, well, can you hear me now? I'm crying now, hoping you know. Hey!
begin to wrap up, a couple of final questions before we finish. What are the classic stories of your career you tell your grandchildren?
God, blimey. Okay, really good one. Top of the Pops with Ocean Kerosene. It was probably about the 12th time we've done it. So they've given us the biggest dressing room at the TV studio. On the same show, you've got Diana Ross and Mariah Carey. Okay. They both presume that the big dressing room is theirs. So we're in it. So Diana Ross's people come in to tell us to get out. So we tell them to fuck off. Then Mariah Carey's people come in to tell us to get out. So we tell them to fuck off. And then this whole almighty argument ensues between Diana Ross's people and Mariah Carey's people as to who is the biggest act in the building. And how come those lot have got the big dressing room? So then our manager just calmly told them that we've actually selling a lot more records than you do, so why don't you fuck off?
Amazing.
Obviously, I would tell that to my grandchildren without swearing.
Amazing. And how did that go down?
Didn't go down well at all.
I love the fact that the OCS were the biggest divas out of three.
That was brilliant. Another great one, TFI Friday.
Yeah.
Prince was playing, and Larry Graham, who's the big bass player in Sign of the Family Stone, one of my all-time absolute heroes. So I'm watching him soundcheck. He knows who I am, so that gets me to come up on stage to chat to him.
To Prince?
Yeah, no, to chat to
Larry, sorry, yeah,
Larry
to, yeah.
Graham. So Larry Graham's asking me to come up. Yeah. Then Prince gets up on stage.
Right.
Larry Graham doesn't tell me to get off. So I'm still talking to Larry Graham whilst Prince is there looking at me.
Oh.
Like, who are you?
Really?
Yeah. And then another good one, I met Janet Jackson backstage at her album launch. I can't remember why I was even there, because I wouldn't normally go to those sort of things. But yeah. Janet Jackson's just performed. I'm at the VIP bar. She walks in with all her entourage. And I just looked at her and said, right, Janet, do you want a pint? And she just looked me up and down and just almost gave me the worst evils, and then just turned her back. I don't know if my grandchildren think those are interesting.
No, that's amazing. Okay, and reflecting back on your career, how did it play out differently to what you thought it was going to be?
I presume the Ocean Colosseum would get better and we'd get bigger and bigger and bigger. That's the only thing, because I think we plateaued too soon. I think we had a lot more to give. But it's those sort of things, record label pressures, because when Moshe Shaw's did so well, it was like the label were, we need the new album, we need the new album. So March the Red, even though it went to number one, wasn't as good. And then as soon as you make a record that's not as good as your last one, I think it's impossible to reverse the trend, I think. So that's only one disappointment. But how it's panned out, I never presumed it would be so successful, you know.
And that success, how is that in reality in comparison to what you thought success would entail?
Oh, gosh. I think I said it earlier, I never really thought about what success would mean, as in terms of people and money and all this, and travel and all those sort of things that you have to do. I just wanted to make cool music. That would be successful. You know, the fact that I'm able to do that, still able to make cool music, and have a general freedom as well. So that
freedom for
to do what I want to do. You know, yeah. I don't have to work with Richard.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to be a lecturer at the University of South Wales. But yeah. I choose to do it because I love both of those things. So that's success for me.
Options,
yeah. And the fact, you know, I mean, successful, even my kids come in to see me play. They've never seen me play, you know, younger ones. We did a Children in Need festival with Richard, I think Chris Evans festival he puts on. And they'd never seen me play before.
Really?
Yeah. And we, you know, we did a very, very sort of punkish set. It was a bit like the Velvet Underground with a bit of songs, because they're Richard songs. And the kids were blown away.
Really?
You know, we went on after all these smooth pop acts, and then we just made an absolute racket, and the kids loved it. So that was really cool. So that's success.
Making the kids proud.
Yeah.
I like that.
Whereas the younger me would have had no concept in making kids proud, you know.
Absolutely. That's the journey of the musician.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, and final question. Might be a biggie.
Mm-hmm.
What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might they be addressed?
Oh, blimey. Okay. Fears for the music industry. Well, there are no great British acts at the minute. You know, you look at the people that are coming through, George Ezra, James Bay, Tom O'Dell, they're all nice people, all their songs are okay. There's no danger there's no punk spirit, which is what the whole Britpop movement, even though it wasn't really a movement, had that punk spirit very much so. Yeah, that's that sort of fuck you attitude where it's all very careerist now. That needs to be addressed. There's a really good British band called Glass Animals who are starting to get somewhere. They've got something really cool going on. 21 Pilots, an American band, they're absolutely brilliant. But I think my fears are that people don't listen to enough great records. They consume stuff quickly off YouTube. So aspiring musicians and songwriters will listen. They consume milkshake as opposed to going to the cow. Mm. What I mean by that, if you're a soul singer, say a new soul singer, maybe he or she will see artists on YouTube, maybe Beyonce or Rihanna. They should actually fuck that off to go and listen to Aretha Franklin.
Yes, they really.
And then they'll understand what inspired Beyonce and Rihanna, who are nowhere near as good.
Yeah.
So it all gets diluted. And the whole thing...
Water down.
Right? Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. So it's milkshake.
Yeah.
It's not the cow. People need to discover the cow and spend time listening to music instead of just continually listening to something new, sound bites.
Mm.
You know, you get loads of drummers these days who only watch other drummers doing drum covers on YouTube instead of actually listening to the great drummers like Mitch Mitchell. Why was he a great drummer? Because he could play with Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Not because he could play really fast.
Mm.
He probably, you know, technically probably wasn't the best in the world, but he was one of the world's greatest musicians.
Mm.
And then consumption of music, everyone consumes it for free, it's worth more than a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, that won't change, but I think people who make it and people who like it need to say what it's worth.
How might that be addressed? How can that be changed?
It could be changed through, it can't be changed through everyone deciding all of a sudden, oh, actually, okay, I will spend a tenner instead of streaming it for free or, you know, ripping the audio off YouTube. But I think it can be addressed, government policy, arts funding. Not that the general public will necessarily listen to what a government white paper would say, but if people start to place it on a par with a Michelangelo painting or a great ballet or an opera, because it's still the thing where you have the high arts and then the low arts, and pop music is a low art, but it isn't really. It's the same creative process.
Would that solve it though? So if there was free tickets to an opera that was really, really quality, or opportunity to see Michelangelo for free fed to you all the time, would people not just do the same anyway? What can we do about
that? Yeah, to some degree. But I mean, when you go to an art gallery, if it's free, there's a donation box and everyone puts money in.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Because people respect what they're seeing.
Yeah.
You know.
But you think there's less respect for music?
There's less respect for music. People pay for... Okay, the way it is now is people pay for an artist's time. So people love music, but they consume it for free. So that value, they don't value it as a thing, as an art product, but they value going to see the artist. So they will then spend a lot more on ticket prices and spend more on merchandise just to have those 2 or 3 hours in the presence of the artist.
Yeah,
and even to buy VIP packages where you can have a hamper and go meet them and all that. Yeah. But that's not punk.
No. Black Sabbath are doing that. Funny enough, that's I only saw yesterday awful. A VIP package to meet the band and all this kind of stuff. Like, their gigs coming up. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, people have to make ends meet and make tours function. But, you know, pop music is an art form.
Yeah.
You know.
But
the upside is that it's easier to make music in terms of finances, where you know, without a record label, you couldn't afford to make music in the past. Then obviously the downside of that is there's an absolute load of torrents of shit on SoundCloud and YouTube. You know, what I think people need to do, as soon as you've written 4 songs, don't think, oh, I'm releasing an EP. Write 400 songs, then pick your best 10. That's what people used to do. I was having a chat with some people the other day, and they were saying, you know, oh yeah, I've written these new songs. I said, do you know that first Verve album, Storm in Heaven? Yeah. I said, do you think that was their first 10 jams? Or do you think they had 10,000 jams and that mutated into 10 songs? Mm. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
And then you know full well that they'll record them on their mate's laptop and stick them on SoundCloud and wonder why no one ever likes them, and then split up.
Great point. Sound advice. Okay, so we'll wrap up there. Thanks for coming on, Damon. Thank you for sharing your wisdom, not only on the podcast, but through the work you do for the South Wales University. I'm guessing in a few hours from now, you'll be singing in harmony with Richard Ashcroft on Science of Silence, backed by a 32-piece orchestra. So I think that's probably a fucking splendid way to spend one's evening.
Absolutely, why not?
thanks for all your wisdom, and I hope you enjoyed appearing. And thanks for your use it and keep it up, and thanks for appearing.
Thank you very much, my pleasure.
Come on, tell me who you are.
more episodes featuring musicians who've worked closely with the likes of the Beatles, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, and many more, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, and check out our new Instagram page. We'll see you at the end of January for Ezra Furman. See you then.